This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
You are listening to the longest running, weekly, episodic comic book podcast in all Place to Be Nation.
Broadcasting from the state-of-the-art L-shaped studios at beautiful and serene Hoholoon Plaza in Vancouver, British Columbia, Greg Phillips and Nick Duke are the hard-traveling fanboys.
When you hear their show, you better run for cover.
Tom Dog Bill's a sausage lover.
Ooh, Hot Traveling Fanboys. It's a weekly podcast and you better listen.
Keep your ears in mint condition.
Ooh, Hot Traveling Fanboys.
You got a 33-1/3 chance of winning.
Place to Be Nation! How do you like it? How do you like it? The hard-traveling fanboys are back, baby, and better than ever. We're here in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. I am Greg Phillips. With me on this crazy little thing called life, the journey of life, that is my journey, or perhaps my foreigner, Nick Duke. Nick, how are you on this nondescript weekday?
I'm doing all right. And, you know, folks, you may be sitting there wondering to yourselves, what's gotten into Greg Phillips? Why is he so amped up? Why is he so peppy here to start this podcast? And the answer, people, the answer is that he's drunk. And no, not drunk on alcohol. Drunk on his own abuses of power. And that's all I have to say about that.
Well, quite frankly, if some individuals, and I'm not here to name names, unlike you, but if some individuals who regularly host this show and aren't named Greg Phillips would stop trying to circumvent and bend the rules of fantasy football.
Now, wait just a moment. What rules were
commissioners?
What rules
would not have to step in?
What rules
and assert their authority?
What rules were circumvented? I would love to hear this.
Rules of common decency.
Rules of decency.
Trying to hoodwink.
No.
Inexperienced fantasy
football player. There you go again with your fake news and your propaganda, Greg. The fact of the matter is this.
Wrong.
The trade was
wrong.
Proposed to me.
Wrong.
What am I supposed to do?
Wrong.
What am I supposed to do, Greg? Am I
wrong.
Supposed to just say, oh, out of the goodness of my heart, I'm going to say no. Is that what I'm supposed to do?
Wrong.
See? Much
Quite
like,
frankly.
Much like our president, you have no real facts to offer. You're just
wrong. I have the best facts.
Cheap,
I have all the best facts.
Cheap,
my facts are better than yours.
Cheap phrases and bullshit to get your way through a conversation in which you're clearly
my
outclassed.
Phrases are the best. My cheap phrases are the best. You're just jealous because you don't have as many good cheap phrases as me. Mm-hmm. That's the problem. You're jealous. Mm-hmm. But quite frankly, I would suggest I intervened on behalf of the league after other owners
intervene on behalf of the league, and I can tell you why. I'll tell you why you did that. No, you want to hear why you did that, Greg? I'll tell you. I'll tell you why you did that.
The Hilton Hulkamaniacs.
Because for most of your fantasy football existence, you have been looking up at the golden brown, perfectly tanned
teaster.
Of the Hilton Hulkamaniacs, and
I got receipts, Nick. I've got the results.
You got scared.
Of every year that
you
we've been
scared.
Doing fantasy
and it's
football.
Just, it's
would you like me to post them
really
on
like,
on Facebook?
Remember when Chris Paul was going to go to the Lakers, and everyone was so upset about it just because they hate the Lakers so much because the Lakers are a dominant franchise that people whined and bitched until David Stern overturned the trade? That's essentially what happened here. I have been on top for so long that there is Hilton Hulkamaniac fatigue. And quite frankly, you know, that's just that is the way
Hilton
of
Hulkamaniacs,
our society.
The Hilton Hulkamaniacs are nothing like David Stern. They're more like Daniel Stern.
No, you are David Stern in this scenario, Greg.
And you are Daniel Stern in this scenario, a relic of the past.
I am the Los Angeles Lakers in this scenario.
No! I can show you the results. The Hilton Hulkamaniacs haven't been relevant since 2012.
That's just a unique opinion to have.
Run
coming
of
from
mediocrity.
Somebody who is.
I don't want to hear this. This is not about my team. We're not going to talk about my team.
Glancing up
We're
in
talking
the
about the league. The good of the league. That's right. We on the Hard Traveling Fanboys are talking about the good of our fantasy football league. That's what we're here to talk about today. Mm-hmm. And I am saying other owners expressed some concerns mm-hmm. about the competitive integrity of our league. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Other owners who I noticed were also ripping the same person off for draft picks, but those went through just fine, I see. I see how it is, Greg. That's fine. At least I know where the it's fine. It's fine. At least I know how scared you are at this point. I understand how intimidated you are and what tactics you will stoop to try and preserve.
Intimidated. Scared. I have not seen
a chance at victory.
Any kind of trade come across my desk as the league commissioner. And I will tend to any such issues as they arise. Mm-hmm. As they arise. I'm looking at it right now. Pending trade between Troy again and Hilton Hulkamaniacs. Now, see, that is a fair trade. Look at that.
Oh, my Lord. My Lord. You are just – you're something else. You know that?
There. It's done.
You're something else.
Right here, folks, we are getting business deals done. We are making things happen right here. Right here at the Hard Traveling Fanboy Studios. But what are we really here to talk about today? Not fantasy football. If you left, please come back. Please.
Or
please come back.
Give a shit.
Sure. We are here to bring you another edition of the greatest listicle show on Place to Be Nation comics. And that would be Countdown. This is our show where, as the title implies, we list our favorite or least favorite five things from the comic book world. It could be movies, TV shows, comics, runs, creators, what have you. Characters. It could be any of these things. In this case, we are here to count down, and this is a pretty nebulous topic, admittedly, but we are here to count down our favorite, brace yourself, retcons. In the history of comics. Now, what is a retcon? Some of you out there that aren't regular comic readers may be asking. A retcon is abbreviation for retroactive continuity. And what that means is it's not unique to comics. You see it on television and in movie franchises and things like that. But it happens more frequently, I think it's fair to say, Nick, in the world of comics. Because of the ongoing serial nature of comics going back to the 1930s, this is when some writers come on and introduce changes to the accepted narrative of the character. For instance, just as a random one that won't make my list but came close to making it and was in consideration, the character of Alfred, the loyal butler for Batman, when he first started in the comics in the 1940s, he was just a bumbling butler who showed up at Bruce Wayne's doorstep with Bruce as an adult. Now, years later, that was changed by a writer to shore things up and give us the Alfred we all know and love. That's just an example of a retcon. Mm-hmm. And I'm taking it from your side, Nick, that we may have that mentioned later on in the show. But I was just nevertheless – trying to find an example of a retcon that I didn't think would make either of our lists. But that's what a retcon is. It's when a writer or an editor introduces a change to the continuity of a character or a line of comics. It happens all the time. Usually retcons are maligned. Comic book fans are notoriously opposed to any changes to their characters. People will fight them tooth and nail. Sometimes these changes are for the worse. Sometimes they're for the better. Sometimes they stick. Sometimes they're almost immediately undone. See Zorn. but what we are here to talk about is the good ones. The ones that, to us, did stick, did make an impact, and improved their characters or their narratives in a sufficient way. Nick, did I do a decent job of summing up our topic today?
you did a pretty good job. I would argue that the example was not really needed, but nonetheless, I think you did a pretty good job. You did such a good job, in fact. You seem to have such a wonderful grasp on the concept of a retcon, Greg, that why don't you just go ahead and lead off our countdown?
I think I will. I do have a great grasp on what a retcon is.
And you have an even better grasp on exactly what your top five is and the exact order that it's in. In no way are you just making this up right now because you're not prepared. In no way
is
that happening.
That's right. It's not happening. I have a list right in front of me that I'm reading off of right now. It's printed out on a laser printer paper with the little things, the little columns on the side that you can rip off, you know. Mm-hmm. It's pretty cool. I'm reading it right now. And, you know, one of the things that I found, Nick, and I'm not sure if you found this as well, because we deliberately did not set strict criteria for ourselves on this in terms of what qualifies as a retcon or what doesn't. But then in a weird circumstance of events here, I found myself, even though there was no reason for me to do so, second-guessing myself on some of my picks on my list of whether they were retcons or reboots. Did you have this same problem, Nick? Probably not. I just tend to overthink things.
No, I didn't. I didn't have that problem at all.
So I did not include something that I was planning on including, which is the entirety of John Byrne's Man of Steel. I was going to wrap it up into one listing: the Kents being alive, Superman being the last son of Krypton, Lex Luthor being an evil businessman, which to me is one of the greatest character changes in comics. But I didn't, because I feel like we can use that later on for another topic of the greatest character changes, because it was a reboot technically instead of a retcon. So all that being said, my number five comes to us from Marvel Comics, and it comes to us in the form of the Brestular character of a movie we just recently reviewed, and that would be Captain America, the Winter Soldier, and this is the Brestular character, the Winter Soldier. Bucky Barnes. This was a pretty huge retcon, actually, on the part of Marvel Comics, because for the better part of 60 years, Bucky was one of the few characters in comics that was considered his death was considered sacred. The characters you always heard would never come back are Uncle Ben and Bucky. They'll never bring those two back. And then later on, people added Jason Todd to that. Jason Todd, Bucky, and and Uncle Ben. So imagine the surprise and the weird coincidence as well, because DC at around the same time was bringing back the character of Jason Todd as the Red Hood. So imagine the surprise of people when Marvel, around the same time, decides it's the best time to bring back Bucky, the character that it seemed like he would never come back from the dead, certainly. Well, Ed Brubaker, the talented writer, opted to do this, and it ended up being one of the best decisions, as far as retcons go, in the history of comics. Not only did it revitalize Captain America and give him a new compelling foe and a new compelling wrinkle to his World War II backstory, but it also created a brand new marketable character for Marvel, which is really hard to do in the modern era. We've talked about it before on this show, Nick, just the difficulty of creating new characters in comics or a new coat of paint on characters in comics that actually stick. And this was such a clever reinvention for so many reasons. First of all, by bringing in the Winter Soldier, you're taking a character in Bucky who had been dead for 60 years. And because he had been dead for 60 years in the comics, people didn't really have an attachment to him. There weren't a whole lot of, 70-year-old people running around who were really attached to Bucky from when they were kids and had a very strong, firm idea of what Bucky should be. Because of that, the writer was given a lot more leeway in terms of how he could define Bucky, how he could shape him as a character. It also gave you a chance to add a new dynamic to Captain America's sometimes one-dimensional approach to Captain America's storytelling. It gave you a whole new area to play with of personal sacrifice and personal drama for Cap of seeing his loyal companion brought back from the dead as an enemy, as someone who was out to kill him. Just a great, brilliant move by Marvel, a brilliant move by Ed Brubaker, who pitched it to them and executed it flawlessly. And to me, this is the best example, Nick, of taking a dead character, bringing them back, and folding it into the continuity in a way that, yes, it is retconning, and yes, it's playing with things that had – it's contradicting things that have been said in the past, but it does so in a way that actually enhances the universe as opposed to take away from it.
Yeah, I would absolutely 100% agree with your assessment of it. It's a great retcon. It's one that didn't make my list just because I've only read The Winter Soldier once, and it's not one that has a huge emotional tie for me, but it is one that I very much enjoy. So I agree with it making your list. But one thing that retcons can do, Greg, is they can sometimes just remove entire stories from existence.
Yes.
And when stories are really bad, that can be a good thing. And so no list of mine will be complete without me making a reference to my beloved Ultimate Universe on the Marvel side. So my number five, I am going to talk about the the disappearance of the Ultimate Iron Man comics from the Ultimate Universe continuity. And let me explain. In the wake of the success of Ultimates Volume 1 and Volume 2, one of the characters that was handled extremely well by Mark Miller and Brian Hitch was that of Tony Stark, the ultimate version of Iron Man. And it was considered something of a major coup for Marvel that they were able to convince famed science fiction author Orson Scott Card to come over and write two different Ultimate Iron Man prequel miniseries that would flesh out Tony Stark's backstory.
Sounded like a
great idea in theory. However, in execution, what we got was one of the most bizarre things in history. It is revealed in these prequel miniseries that Tony Stark is only intelligent because his mother experimented on him in the womb, and the experiments resulted in him developing brain tissue all over his entire body. So because he had more brain cells covering his entire body, it made him really smart. However, it also made his skin very sensitive, and sunlight would harm his skin because of the brain cells were so sensitive to outside factors, leading his father, Howard, to create for him a biomechanical suit of armor. But that didn't really look like armor. It looked like a blue liquid that made him look like a member of the Blue Man Group when he walked around. And
Blue
that could,
Man Group!
And that could be removed, and I'm not kidding, by simply washing it off with soap. So you had this going on, and all the meanwhile was eventually revealed that his brain tissue was so smart that if the brain tissue on his hand was cut off, it would automatically regenerate, giving him the ability to lose entire body parts and regrow them at will, thus rendering him essentially invulnerable, and making it completely ridiculous, seeing as how in the Ultimates miniseries he was revealed to have a brain tumor. But if he's able to regenerate all of his cells, why wouldn't he just regenerate, you know, new cells in the place of the tumor? But I digress. All these things go on. You eventually get to Tony in the Iron Man suit, but it's what happens along the way is a brutal series of murders where pretty much everyone around Tony is killed off, and you just get these increasingly odd decisions made with the character that completely contradict the very limited backstory that we had gotten from Miller and Hitch in the Ultimates. And so, in the wake of these two volumes, when Miller came back to do Ultimate Comics Avengers, he actually took what Orson Scott Card had done and made a reference to it being a terrible anime series that existed in the Ultimate Universe and retconned it out of existence as an official backstory for the Ultimate version of Iron Man. And they actually led to, a few years later, somebody else coming on and doing a new Ultimate Comics Iron Man series that was, while not great, at the very least, much, much better than the bunch of bizarre bullshit that Orson Scott Card busted out. So for my number five, I'm going with Miller just wholesale removing those two storylines from the Ultimate Universe continuity.
What I'm getting from that, never trust a comic book writer with three names.
Well,
let's move on to my number four. on my completely put together list of things here. And I am going to go to what you know, Nick, to be what I occasionally call my favorite DC Comics story. It's probably been – it may have been surpassed in recent years by some Green Lantern stuff, but it's still my favorite Batman story and still holds a special place in my heart as being the most important comic book story I ever read for my fandom. I'm going to go all the way back to 2002 and Batman Hush – or 2003, I'm sorry, Batman Hush. And my retcon here for number four is the entire existence of Tommy Elliott, a.k.a. Hush. This is a retcon that still to this day bugs some people, some Batman fans. But for me, I like it because maybe it's because I hadn't read any other stories to that point from Batman's history about him having a secret childhood friend that we didn't know about to this point, which admittedly can be a stretch for some. For me, it is not in this case. Tommy Elliott was, as we find out, a childhood friend of Bruce Wayne, one of his few. And Tommy and Bruce shared a lot of similarities. They both had wealthy parents. They both were a little socially awkward. They both kind of flocked to each other as kids and enjoyed adventures. They both were inspired by watching the original Green Lantern, Alan Scott, patrol the skies of Gotham. But they also had differences. Whereas Bruce's parents were loving and caring, Tommy's parents were essentially not. They were very cold and distant and verbally and mentally abusive to Tommy. And both of them, both Tommy and Bruce, lose their parents at an early age. Bruce's parents, of course, we know, were killed by a gunman. And it caused pearls to fall in slow motion. And Tommy, on the other hand, actually cuts the brake line, I believe, to his parents' vehicle in an attempt to kill them and inherit their fortune. Unfortunately for Tommy, his mother survives and continues to plague him by being an overbearing mother for the rest of her natural life. So this character is a huge retcon because we had never heard about this since, you know, to that point, almost 70 years of Batman storytelling. We had never heard about him having at least I had never heard of him having a childhood friend that, you know, moved away at a certain point or anything like that. But here he returns to Gotham. He pops up at Gotham as a renowned surgeon who comes in to help Bruce when he's suffered an injury in the midst of battle. And to me, it sets the stage for the most exciting Batman story. The one that I go back to all the time and the one that holds the most special place in my heart. So because of that, it lands a spot in my countdown at number four. Admittedly, not as impactful a retcon as the rest of them that will be on my list most likely, but a retcon that nonetheless to me added a new wrinkle to the mythos and added just yet another element of tragedy to Bruce Wayne's backstory.
Yeah, I gotta admit, I completely blanked on this one. This is a great choice on your part. The existence of Tommy Elliott absolutely counts as a retcon. I mean, we had seen numerous takes on Bruce Wayne's childhood to that point and never gotten anything said about a character known as Tommy Elliott. So, great choice on your part. Going back to the Ultimate Universe, however, for my number four, I am going to go with Brian Michael Bendis and his decision to retcon the death of Ultimate Peter Parker, to bring him back to life, if only so briefly. I believe Bendis has never come out and said this, but Bendis, I believe, knew that the Ultimate Universe was coming to an end and wanted to give longtime fans one last bone by seeing for the first time on the printed page the ultimate versions of both Peter Parker and Miles Morales standing side by side in battle. And so about a year and a half before the Ultimate Universe ended, we actually got that. We got a look at the resurrection of Peter Parker. It wasn't completely explained how it happened. It was mysterious government facility to way, essentially. Peter woke up in a mysterious government facility and made his way out at that point and went and confronted Miles because he saw someone wearing his costume and using his web shooters, and he was asking for the web shooters back. It also led to a fantastic final glimpse at Peter in the Ultimate Universe of him and MJ looking out at the horizon and basically realizing that their futures were wide open at this point, and they could go anywhere they wanted and be anywhere they wanted together, because Peter trusted Miles to continue on the legacy of Spider-Man. And the great thing about this is Bendis was recently asked about this in at a con, and they asked if he had any plans to ever follow up on that, and he gave a cryptic stay tuned answer. So the idea that Ultimate Peter might not be done just yet just fills me with such hope. It's again kind of like yours. It's not very impactful. I can't say it played a huge role, but it was a moment that I had always wanted to see two of my favorite characters from the Ultimate Universe getting to stand side by side and getting Miles that moment of, you know, getting to meet the guy who inspired him all those years ago. So that's where I'm going with my number four. I know it's admittedly very, very fan servicey, but I can't help but admit that I marked out for it. So Ultimate Peter's Resurrection takes my number four spot.
Very good. Great choice there. For my number three position, I've got one that might be a little controversial, because I know a lot of people who are fans of Batman in particular have very strong opinions on this one way or the other. And there are a lot of great arguments for both sides of this. And there are people that like them both. And I can see the arguments for both. But the one that I'm going with is one that, unfortunately, to my taste on the character, was undone after Infinite Crisis. And this was a retcon that was introduced around the time of Zero Hour, where Bruce Wayne did not know who killed his parents. For many, many years, of course, Joe Chill was the rather interesting name of the gentleman who killed Bruce Wayne's parents, Thomas and Martha. And in a famous story from the 40s, and then again post-crisis in Batman Year 2, Bruce Wayne finds Joe Chill and reveals to him who he is, only for Joe Chill, when his colleagues find out that he's the one responsible for Batman, to kill him before he can tell them Batman's true identity. A great story from Bill Finger and Bob Kane back in the day. And for many years, that was just the case. Joe Chill killed his parents, died, and that's that. Well, this change, which was introduced around the time of Zero Hour back in the early 90s, is it basically wiped that out. And it said that through some time manipulation, Bruce is able to see Joe Chill on the night that his parents were murdered and finds out that Joe Chill did not kill his parents after all. And in fact, he never finds out who killed his parents. It's a mystery lost to time. And while a lot of people don't like that because they think that it keeps his mission as being about vengeance, that's not actually how it played out. Because what it ends up doing to me is it adds deeper thematic meaning to Batman's journey. Because by not knowing who killed his parents, suddenly he can't put a face to it. It's not – to him, crime doesn't look like Joe Chill. To him, crime could be anything because he doesn't know who it is. He doesn't know who that person looked like, what age, race, sex that person was that killed his parents. It could be anyone. It could be anything. And so to me, it added value to his mission. It added – a little bit of pathos to his mission, where suddenly there was never going to be – he's never going to get that satisfaction, in other words, of finding out who did it and catching them. That's never going to exist for him. So to me, it makes Batman be about more than Bruce Wayne's mission. It makes Batman be about making sure – this never happens to anyone else. Making sure to the best of his ability that he can create a world, create a Gotham where people like whoever this individual was don't exist, where people can walk the streets safely. And the idea that Bruce Wayne is going to continue to have to deal with this, it also keeps his parents' death meaningful. Because I think, Nick, we've talked about this before. One of the many reasons that I loved Jason Todd's death and Jason Todd being dead is that to me it helped the suspension of disbelief about his mission. Because to me, if his parents were killed and he catches the killer at a certain point over a certain amount of time, it's natural that that edge would wear off a little bit, that that reasoning, that motivation would wear off a little bit. And so in a Jason Todd is resurrected world, it makes sense to me, or it would make sense to me if it were still around, that one of the reasons his parents are still his driving motivation is that he will never get that satisfaction. And that to him, any perp that he busts could very well be the one that killed his parents. Or any person he encounters in a train station. Any person who's working in Gotham right now. It could be anyone. And so I like that edge that it adds to Batman. I understand it's a controversial thing, but a lot of people like it. A lot of people don't like it. To me, it was a change that really helped the character and added a new wrinkle. Again, I use this word a lot, but wrinkles. It added a new wrinkle to Bruce Wayne's backstory and made it more interesting than just trudging over the same old material to artificially manufacture, some backstory that added another layer to his tragedy. Like I just mentioned Tommy Elliott, who I love, but this was a way of kind of building that in naturally where there's always going to be this new wrinkle there. And I like mystery in comics. I just do. I like when comics don't answer all the questions and when they leave some things up for interpretation and some things that you can revisit in the future, maybe for stories. And to me, this is one that I had to get on my list.
Yeah, I think I tend to lean your way as well. I think I tend to prefer it that Batman never knew. Although I can also enjoy the Joe Chill interpretation. I thought the Nolan films especially handled the Joe Chill character very well by having kind of getting to have your cake and eat it too. Getting to have Batman know or have Bruce know that it was Joe Chill, but also use Joe Chill to illustrate that the problem is so much bigger than just Joe Chill. You know, thought they handled it very, very well. Just out of curiosity, would you then prefer a take on Dick Grayson where he doesn't know that it was Tony Zucco?
To a point. I think the story of Bruce revealing Tony Zucco to Dick is very, very compelling. And to me, it's a compelling story if Bruce gets that information about what does he do with it. Because if Bruce never finds out who killed his parents and that fuels his mission, does he keep that information from Dick in order to keep his eye on the prize, so to speak? Does a part of him worry that if he gives that information to Dick, that Dick will get closure and will want to move on? Bruce probably tells him the information, but I think that story is so compelling to tell. But personally, I would be fine with a version where Dick Grayson didn't know. I am perfectly fine with that as well. I think the only problem with that, Nick, is if you do it with both characters, it might be a little bit of overkill, particularly because – if Bruce Wayne takes in Dick Grayson, he's the world's greatest detective, and he's going to find out who killed Dick Grayson's parents. If it's that important to Bruce at this point in his life when he's this good of a detective and it just happened, he's going to find out who did it. And then it becomes a story of how long do you stretch out Bruce keeping it or keeping his mission from Robin. Luckily, we've had a great story told about that on the animated series. Mm-hmm. With the Robin's Reckoning episode. So yeah, to answer your question, I would be fine with it if it was isolated, but I wouldn't want both of them to not know who killed their parents.
I got you. Well, moving on to my number three, we're going to go back to the world of Batman, and it's one that Greg actually mentioned earlier, and that is basically Alfred Pennyworth's entire young adulthood. At one point, the version of Alfred that was in the early Bob Kane and Bill Finger comics was actually much more akin to the Google-eyed version from the 1966 Adam West show, kind of a bumbling idiot who would go on adventures with them and didn't really have much tie personally to Bruce and Dick.
And,
he just kind of showed up one day and started working for him.
He just walked in the door. The panel is great. He just walks in the door as Bruce and Dick look at each other astonished as this fat man walks in the door and plops his umbrella down and gets to work as with his butlering.
Yes, just kind of randomly walks in, played for comedy a lot of the times, and even disappears for a long stretch of those early Batman stories and then makes an odd return as a villain known as the Outsider, which they would later use as the inspiration for the Earth-3 version of Alfred that came over as during the build-up to Forever Evil. to herald the arrival of Greg?
The Crime Syndicate.
Crime Syndicate. There you go. In that big crossover during the New 52. But basically, much like what happened with Superman in the wake of Crisis on Infinite Earths, Batman kind of had his origin story revamped a little bit. And to me, one of the most important aspects of this in this post-crisis continuity is changing Alfred's involvement in Bruce's life. Gone is the Alfred that just randomly walked in one day, and he is replaced with an Alfred who felt honor-bound to take over his father's post as Wayne family butler. So he comes to Wayne Manor, he works there, he's miserable, he decides he doesn't like it, he's going to leave, and then the Waynes die, and he feels honor-bound to stay with Bruce and become his legal guardian and protect him and essentially raise him as his own. If you watch and enjoy the version of Alfred on the horrible television show Gotham, that version of Alfred doesn't exist without this particular retcon. The Michael Caine interpretation of the character in the Dark Knight trilogy by Chris Nolan doesn't exist without this particular retcon. Pretty much the Alfred character as we know and love him and the relationship he has with Bruce at this point in terms of Alfred really being the only person that Bruce lets see his true personality, that true personality where Batman and Bruce Wayne kind of blend together and become one person. None of that happens without this retcon. So it is so important to both Batman, to Alfred Pennyworth, and to really the entire Bat family, because Alfred has kind of been the glue that bonds the Bat family together at this point. You know, Dick and Tim and Damian all go through their periods of love and hate with Bruce. They have their fallings out. They go through their ups and downs. But Alfred is the one character that keeps them coming back and is able to bring them together in the midst of so many different tragic situations. So without this retcon, you know, the Bat family as we know it probably doesn't look the same and may not even exist. So I got to give major props to DC Comics for making this decision. And I got to admit, it's one of my favorite retcons in the history of comics, just because I've always loved that Alfred Pennyworth character. I've always loved Bruce's rich supporting cast, and this just adds so much to that supporting cast.
Yes, Alfred's the one of the few that gets to see him, not as Bruce Wayne or as Batman, but as Bruce Batman. Mm-hmm. And but yeah, wasn't that a Frank Miller innovation?
I believe it was a Frank Miller innovation during year one, I want to say, but I'm not positive about that.
Yeah, year one or Dark Knight Returns, one or the other. It was a Frank Miller story that got that change instituted. So add that to the list of reasons that Bat fans will always be indebted to Frank Miller, no matter how crazy he gets. So yeah, great choice there, Nick. Certainly a character-changing and character-defining one. For my number two spot, I'm going with one that could very easily finish atop the list because it's – and it's a character that I've never read much of in the comics, but it's a change that is so fundamental, a change that when you hear that it's a change may shock you that it's a retcon, a change that is probably as essential or more essential to its character than any other. And that change is the version of Captain America that we all know and love. I'm trying to think of a way to put it, and that's just the only thing I can come up with of how to put it.
I mean, you'll have to kind of explain about how the Golden Age characters of comics were kind of killed off, for lack of a better term, there for a long time.
So, essentially, this change had Captain America rooted in World War II. And the original version of Captain America, here's what people don't know. When he was created by Joe Simon and Jack Kirby, he fought in World War II with Bucky. We all know about that. But here's the thing. After World War II ended, the characters continued on. They didn't just go away. We were still getting Captain America comics. And in this case, they fought on through the end of the 40s and into the 1950s. And their enemies changed from Nazis to communists. They fought the Red Menace. Well, at some point in the 50s, Captain America and Bucky went on their own way, and the line ended. The characters were basically done away with, as all the Golden Age characters were. They just stopped being written. And superhero comics, as many people know, died in the 50s to be replaced by, largely anyway, by romance comics and horror comics and things like that. Well, let's fast forward to the Marvel Age, the 1960s, and right back to Jack Kirby, and this time alongside writer Stan Lee. They create this super team called the Avengers. And in issue number 4, they introduce the biggest retcon to the Marvel Universe, arguably. And that is Lee and Kirby had the idea to revive Captain America and retcon it so that Cap was seemingly killed in a plane crash way back in 1945. This is the version of his origin that we all know and grew up reading. He dies in a plane crash in 1945 along with Bucky. Captain America, instead of dying, though, was actually frozen in a block of ice because comics. And the Avengers in issue number 4 find this block of ice and thaw Captain America out. And boom, instantly, we've got a brand new, fresh take on this character where we've got a Captain America who is from 20 years ago, a man out of time. That's kind of the quintessential Captain America story, right? A man displaced by time, and now here's this 1940s guy, and he's stuck in mid-60s America, New York, with all these Avengers, and it's such a unique character. It's unlike anything that had been done before in comics. No other character existed like this. No other character had these sort of defining characteristics. And it's what makes Captain America truly an interesting character. Because other than that, if you just had Captain America, you've just got a patriotic guy who goes over and fights in a war and knocks out Nazis, which is great. But it's not a terribly interesting character. Here, you've got a character who's now, again, pathos. You have a motivating factor for him. How does he adjust to how do his morals adjust? How do his standards adjust? How does he react to a new society? And they cleverly just ignored all those later stories, the 50s stories, the weird communism stories, and it gave room for later Marvel writers to retcon those. And to say that these were replacement Captain's America and replacement Bucky's. And to me, it's just brilliant. And it's another shining example of that creative genius of Kirby and Lee and how they were able to salvage a seemingly irrelevant character for a new era and a new generation of Americans who probably weren't as keen on a character like Captain America, but they made Captain America relevant. They made him interesting. And without this retcon, Nick, I think the argument could be made that Captain America never takes off as a cultural icon, never gets a movie franchise, never becomes one of the linchpins of the Marvel Universe the way that he is today.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. That's a great pick of yours. And it actually has something in common here with my number 2 pick. In that, my number 2 is probably a retcon that a lot of people don't really realize is a retcon. I am going with, over on the DC Comics side, Greg, the very existence of Earth 2 and the Golden Age heroes in mainstream DC continuity. Much like what happened to Captain America after the conclusion of the Golden Age, you know, superhero comics, for the most part, kind of died off. And so when DC Comics started to catch fire there in the late 50s again, primarily with the reintroduction of the Flash and the Green Lantern and various other heroes as a revamped line of superheroes. In the early pages of the Flash, they actually revealed that Barry Allen was a fan of the Golden Age Flash comics when he was a kid, thereby revealing that in this version of the DC Universe, those Golden Age heroes didn't exist. They were merely fictional characters who once had, you know, comics written about them. They were essentially retired, for lack of a better term. Well, fast forward all the way to September of 1961, and The Flash number 123, the iconic story Flash of Two Worlds, where it is revealed that, no, these characters actually still do exist, but they just exist on a parallel Earth. So here in this one story, you have the foundation for not just the return of the Justice Society and the classic Golden Age versions of these heroes, but you also have the building blocks upon which, you know, the larger part of DC's continuity would be built for the next, oh man, you know, 50 years essentially. Because the DC multiverse, that very concept, has been central to every major DC story since Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Yep.
And even predating that. The annual JSA-JLA crossover was looked forward to every year back in the early days of the Silver Age. I've read a lot of those stories, and they're all pretty great. The character of Black Canary, as we know her, would not exist without the reveal that the Earth 2 heroes and the Golden Age heroes still existed. Green Arrow was a character that was able to come back into popularity as a result of this. So many different characters that were able to continue to be used and continue to be moved forward and kind of bridge together two generations of fans, the fans who grew up on the Golden Age heroes and the fans, the new fans of the 50s and 60s who were fans of the Silver Age characters. It also gave you an opportunity to explore interesting alternate versions of the classic Batman and Superman characters, notably a version of Batman who marries Catwoman and has a daughter, a version of Superman that actually ages. You know, we see tragically his version of Lois, you know, die in the pages of Infinite Crisis. So all of that can be traced back to this one retcon of having the Golden Age heroes exist on an alternate Earth. And it really is perhaps the single most important editorial decision in the history of DC Comics. The creative history of the company would be drastically different without this decision. So for that, it takes home the number two spot on my list.
That's a great pick, Nick. I actually am kind of jealous that I didn't think of it myself, because that's a great pick that I guess I don't really think of as being a retcon, but it was. It was definitely a retcon and a vitally important retcon that set the stage for what we have today. And certainly we wouldn't be having kind of crazy events every 10 years like Crisis and Infinite Crisis and Crisis in Time and Final Crisis, DC Metal. We wouldn't be having any of these wacky stories without these original retcons of the Earth 2 heroes. So great choice there. Now, before we get on to our number one selections, I solicited Twitter for some of their favorite retcons. Didn't get a ton of reception to this. Step up your game, folks. But I did promise to read some of these choices out from some of our Twitter followers, and here's what we got. Russell Sellers, the host of the Sellers Points, he chimed in and said, Hal Jordan not being evil and the emotional spectrum, Bucky being the Winter Soldier, Spider-Woman not being an actual spider, I don't know much about that one, Lois and Clark marriage. Awesome choices. And in fact, I'm also sad that I didn't put that one on my list. But everybody knows what a fan I am of Lois and Clark marriage being brought back. That did not make my list, however. The Watch, the_Watch, she mentioned also being a huge fan of the Lois and Clark marriage being brought back in Rebirth. And Joe Johnson, a longtime listener of the show, he says, Lois and Clark marriage, Stick teaching Matt Murdock, Bucky being Winter Soldier, and Alfred knowing Bruce since he was a kid. So great suggestions all around from the listeners out there. And always, we welcome your feedback on the show anyway, but if you want to send us your lists after the fact, we'd be happy to discuss them with you and retweet them and share them around. So send us your lists and we'll put them up there. I'm at gphillips8652. He is at nickduke87. Now, for our number one selections. And Nick, you're going to have to forgive me because mine's a bit of a cheat.
Okay, I'm interested to hear it.
My number one selection is the entirety of Geoff Johns' Green Lantern run.
Oh, my God. All right.
I didn't want to take up my list with multiple Green Lantern entries because that's what it would have ended up being if I was just counting down my five favorite retcons.
Uh-huh.
Let's start with Green Lantern Rebirth. Let's start with, in one fell swoop, fixing the single most problematic Hal Jordan story of them all. And that covers a lot of ground, folks. That covers his underage relationship with Arisha. That covers Hal as a truck driver who hides his truck in space. But nothing did more damage to the character of Hal Jordan.
It covers him banging Guy Gardner's girlfriend while Guy Gardner was in a coma.
Now that's just funny. But what? No story ever in the history of comics did more damage to Hal Jordan. While on its own, I think it's a pretty good story. No story did more damage to a character, an existing heroic character, than did Emerald Twilight to Hal Jordan. Because, oh, he went from being the greatest Green Lantern of them all and one of the five or six or seven pillars of the DC universe to being an insane megalomaniac who murders his best friend, murders the Guardians of the Galaxy, and then tries to recreate the universe in his image. That's a pretty hard thing to come back from, Nick, trying to recreate the universe in your image.
Absolutely.
You've tried it a time or two. I have as well. But it's hard for most to come back from. And Geoff Johns, through the introduction of the emotional spectrum and the introduction in particular of Parallax as an entity versus just being a name that Hal Jordan randomly assumed for himself.
Right. A living embodiment of fear.
The living embodiment of fear. It changed everything because suddenly the onus and the responsibility was lifted from the shoulders of Hal Jordan as a character and placed onto this new entity. So you've basically, with one move, you have redeemed Hal Jordan.
And not just on Hal Jordan, Greg, but also, I would argue, in keeping with a theme that would play out over the rest of Geoff Johns' run, a large portion of the blame has to be placed upon the Guardians, who put Parallax in the battery in the first place, thus creating the yellow impurity, and something they just felt wasn't really important and didn't need to be mentioned to the core over the course of history.
Exactly. And the beauty of that, Nick, is it's in keeping with the gradual characterization of the Guardians that had been building for years in the Green Lantern comics.
Yes, I would agree.
Which made it a perfect retcon because it's building on seeds that were already there. So you, in one fell swoop, you redeem Hal Jordan. You explain away the corniest aspect of the Green Lantern mythos, which is a weakness to yellow. Mm-hmm. I think we can all agree on that. And
you have a legitimate basis for de-aging one of your characters in appearance by explaining away the graying of the temples and Hal Jordan's wrinkled face from the early 90s Gerard. Seriously, from the early 90s Gerard Jones run by having it be explained that Parallax was weakening Hal's confidence and causing him to suffer emotional stress that was aging him prematurely.
Absolutely, and making him look like Vice President Dan Quayle.
There it is.
So that they did that, and on yet another level, you're creating a whole new iconic Green Lantern villain.
Right.
A brand new original character, again, doesn't happen a lot in comics, unfortunately, that would stick, that would become this pillar, not only a pillar villain or a new villain that would show up, but a villain that is essential to the core of Green Lantern, not the core PS, but the core with an E at the end of Green Lantern. And just a brilliant, brilliant motion. But I'm not going to stop there. I'm not going to stop with Hal Jordan redemption.
Let me hop in right there because that actually is my number one spot. I wasn't quite as broad as you are, so I'm going to narrow it down a little bit more and say that my number one is actually specifically the Hal Jordan redemption angle / the Parallax introduction. You can kind of lump that and the creation of the emotional spectrum kind of together in one. I know there are more aspects that you're going to talk about. I have a feeling probably Secret Origin will play a big role there, especially as it relates to Sinestro's character. But for me specifically, being able to rectify what might be, in hindsight, the single greatest case of character assassination in comics history is a massive accomplishment. And not only being able to do that, but have it make some level of sense within the established Green Lantern mythos is just a brilliant piece of writing from Geoff Johns. And you do all that while also it having a tremendous amount of emotional weight to it, and managing to maintain characters like Kyle Rayner and the other supporting Green Lantern characters who had served in Hal's stead since the events of Emerald Twilight without detracting from them in any real noticeable way. Just a masterstroke by Geoff Johns, and for me, was a slam dunk runaway number one on my list.
Yes, and in addition, this is even just in Green Lantern Rebirth, which is his first Green Lantern story, he also manages to retcon Guy Gardner's Voldarian powers that had turned him into Warrior and bring Guy Gardner back into the fold. And, oh, what's that other thing? Ah, yes, Nick. He also manages to bring back the entire Green Lantern Corps concept, which was inexplicably and foolishly removed after the events of Emerald Twilight. Jeff is able to bring Guy back into being a Lantern, bring John Stewart back into the Corps, bring back Kilowog, and reveal, by the way, that those Lanterns that Hal thought he killed in Emerald Twilight were not actually dead and had not been killed. So you bring back Kilowog and all these beloved fan favorite characters, and you do it in a way that continues to add to Hal's redemption. And you, like you said, keep Kyle Rayner around. You manage to retcon out some of the aspects of the Rayner run, like him having the last ring and kickstarting back the core. You create the character of Ion, which gives Kyle his uniqueness to him. You restart this entire mind-expanding concept that is Green Lantern, and you make it what it was meant to be from the beginning. You make it this all-encompassing Star Wars, Lord of the Rings, James Bond hybrid vibe that was missing for so long, and it was such a brilliant move to do. The emotional spectrum itself, such a great addition. Some people don't like the emotional spectrum. Quite frankly, those people are damned fools to hybridize Vince McMahon and Jim Ross. It's just such a great addition because you open the door to all of these great new characters. You give existing characters new meaning, whether it be Carol Ferris as the Star Sapphire. You give her new meaning. You give all of these Black Hand. That's another great retcon. Nick, I was going to throw him out there as well. Black Hand goes from what we read about and reviewed here on the show a few months ago, what he was in the 70s, an inexplicable character. It's just
a tickler of nostrils.
a tickler of nostrils. And Geoff Johns reimagines him as a guy who was obsessed with death, who from an early age found himself not without any exaggeration obsessed with the concept of death, someone who would not necessarily be an evil person for the sake of being evil, but he believed in death. He was fascinated by it, utterly entranced by it, in the way that some of our nation's worst serial killers were. And it was a reimagining that made Black Hand go from a corny, useless Silver Age villain into probably my second favorite Green Lantern villain. And it was just brilliantly realized. It took this is what Geoff Johns made his MO. He took a really lame character and made him relevant again, made him exciting, made him interesting for the first time. So he did that with Black Hand. He also managed to do that with several other characters along the way, in addition to creating new ones. He cleverly retconned Abin Sur and Sinestro by taking a short story from Alan Moore and Kevin Maguire from back in the 80s, the story Tigers, which we talked about in Emerald Knights recently. He took that story, that little snippet of a story, and he stretched that into a 10-year-long run by taking nuggets from that and expounding upon them and taking them to their logical conclusions and drawing things from them and drawing inspiration from just little bits of dialogue in that story with the five inversions and Abin Sur and Cull of the five inversions. And we got, of course, from that, we got Atrocitus. And it managed to change the fundamentals of the Green Lantern universe and introduce a whole new subtext to the existence of the Green Lantern rings, where no longer it was just you have to overcome fear and you can shoot green energy blasts and make constructs. No, now fear is just a part of this vast emotional spectrum, and you actually have to control, in addition to your willpower and in addition to your imagination. They used to say the rings were limited only by your imagination, but in addition to all that, you also have to control your emotions and understand your emotions in a way that you may not expect to. So it adds this militaristic aspect of the Green Lantern Corps, of the regimented training and how important it is, and the Book of Oa and the Book of Sinestro and the Book of the Dead, and just so many great wrinkles to the Green Lantern mythology. And then, of course, like you mentioned earlier, Nick, I can't talk about great retcons without talking about Sinestro. Everything from his name, his family name, his family history, giving him a daughter, making him not just Hal Jordan's colleague, which was an innovation of the Gerard Butler and Keith Giffen era of Green Lantern.
Gerard Jones,
not Gerard Butler, who's a famous actor who is not accused of Gerard Butler, we got no issue with you, sir. But
you would have thought that Gerard Jones wrote the Aresia storyline, but he did not.
No, Gerard I see what you did there. That was an innovation of that era of Green Lantern, where we got Sinestro as a Green Lantern at the same time as Hal. What Geoff Johns did was he took it a step further, and he gave Sinestro that mentorship role over Hal, that he even increased the relationship between Sinestro and Hal and made them friends almost. And not even just almost. We saw that with the last issue of Johns' Green Lantern, that there was an underlying respect and friendship there between Hal and Sinestro, and also gave Sinestro – more importantly than all of that, gave Sinestro motivation that had not existed prior. In other words, Nick, he took Sinestro from being someone who wanted to overthrow the Guardians because they weren't going far enough to somebody who saw that the Guardians were corrupt and wanted to expose that corruption and fulfill the Green Lantern's mission by any means necessary. And yes, he took it too far, and yes, he was still a villain. But he was a villain who was motivated by righteousness in the way that Magneto is motivated by righteousness. And in a course of a 10-year run, Geoff Johns took Sinestro and made him the DC Universe's Magneto. And that is one of – I'll go ahead and say it. That is the greatest character reclamation project in the history of comics.
Wow. Bold statement. Bold statement from Greg Phillips. I would tend to agree, although I would lean a little bit more towards the Hal Jordan side of things, just because we had never seen a hero fall so drastically from grace and be able to be successfully redeemed from that.
True.
But Sinestro was also a great example. Geoff Johns is just the master of character reclamation at this point, so you can't really go wrong with either of those two examples of that from his Green Lantern run.
Yeah, the he is the retcon king, and as far as I'm concerned, if you can do a retcon well, I am willing to accept it. And if it serves the characters, and in this case, it not only served the characters, it made the Green Lantern mythos more than it was before. And that's a very rare thing in comics, and one that should be celebrated, as we do every few months here, it seems like. We find new ways to celebrate that run of Green Lantern comics. But that's how, in our opinion, that's how vital it was, that's how creative it was, and that's how important it was to this incredible fandom that Green Lantern now has. I know that there were a lot of people that were Green Lantern fans before Geoff Johns came on who that maybe didn't like some of his changes. But I can tell you, as a kid that read him, someone that read some Green Lantern as a kid and somebody that came back years later for the Johns run, to me, these are essential changes. And these gave us what I think is as good a fandom and as good a mythos as there is in all of not just in all of comics, but in all of fiction right now. It's an incredible mythos, And it's one that it would be great if more people would have access to it in the form of, movies or television.
Yeah, that would be phenomenal. I'm still, now that Death and Return of Superman has been announced for that two-part animated film, I am still holding out hope that we'll one day get a true two-part Sinestro Corps War adaptation. And maybe even like just an entire line of Green Lantern animated films. How great would that be?
Oh, that would be phenomenal. Tremendous. Yeah. What are we gonna do? With that being said, I mentioned our Twitter handles. Please tweet us and let us know your favorite retcons in the history of comics. Yeah, ones of course, that stuck.
You tweet us at JR's BBQ on Twitter.
That's right. And let us know what we got right, what we got wrong, how we could have done better, and then send us your lists. And also, go to Facebook.com. It's a place you might have heard of. And sign up for our Place to Be Nation comics page. We invite you to join the discussion there. Tell us what you thought about our latest episodes. Talk about the latest happenings in the world of comic books. Talk about graps, if you want to. I feel like that's something that people say.
Don't you mean the graps?
The graps, I'm sorry. Talk about whatever it is that you feel the need to talk about, and we'll talk to you about it. You know, we have thoughts on many things, but we love comics, and we invite your feedback. And, of course, we do have the loneliest email addresses on the internet, GregP@PlaceToBeNation.com and NickD@PlaceToBeNation.com. If you send us an email, we can't promise we'll find it within the next 3 months, but at some point in the future – you bet your ass we'll read it. We might even respond. You never know.
You never know.
With that said, we're going to take a break. When we come back from the other side, we're going to have Reading, Watching, and the Rundown. Stay with us.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we offer those to you on three great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the original Place to Be podcast, as well as Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, as well as the Our Vantage Point podcast and Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver quick-hit pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Psychology is Dead, Puro Potpourri, Stacy and Elliot's Bogus Journey, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Letters from Center Stage, Space City, and NWA Classics On Demand Adventure, Through the Years, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, and much more. And on our popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, Go Home in a Box, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, Geek and Sassy, and Imaginary Stories podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including the Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to all of our feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. all of these shows, plus others available on PlaceofNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceofNation.com/Amazon when shopping online, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keats' Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceofNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
We're back, ladies and gentlemen. And before we get going into the rest of our story, so to speak, I wanted to bring up a loose thread from last week. As you know, we reviewed the Batman Telltale game.
Mm-hmm.
Did I get that studio name right, Nick?
Yeah, you did.
That's good to know. During the course of this episode, there was some kind of discussion had about a certain part of the game where I said that Harvey Dent was injected with a chemical that had some effects on his personality later in the game. Both our guest, Mr. Sellers, and my esteemed co-host, Mr. Duke, informed me that I was wrong and that there was no chemical injected in Dent during the mayoral debate in this particular chapter of the Batman Telltale game. I am here to respond to that and say that over the course of the last week, I've done some research and I've realized that I was right. In fact, I'm reading directly now from the Telltale Batman Wikia page, which you too can find at batman.wikia.com and search for Batman Telltale. Harvey was held hostage by the group alongside Hill and others at the debate. Taking over the debate, the masked man, who called himself the Penguin, had one of his hostages inject both Dent and Hill with a chemical. As the two were forced to argue under the effects of the chemical, a bunch of other crap happened. So, Nick, I would like to know, how do you respond to this latest information?
Well, I would respond by you saying, you know, by saying that, yes, technically I suppose you were correct, but you were implying that the chemical was directly responsible for the rest of the changes that Harvey underwent throughout the rest of the game, and that was not the implication that I got from it in the least.
I would suggest a replay of the game and a paying of closer attention to the dialogue would illustrate that they make it pretty apparent during the course of the game that the chemicals are still having lingering effects on Harvey.
Yes, but I think you're overstating the importance of them in his eventual psychological breakdown.
Would you at least acknowledge for once on this show that you were wrong about the chemicals not being injected?
Yes, I just did that 90 seconds ago, Greg.
I just would like...
Would you acknowledge on this show for once that you're drunk on your own damn power?
Listen, I am running a league, and I'm just like Roger Goodell, Nick. I have to be subject...
Drunk on your own power, yes. So I think we're finally in agreement here.
...of the other owners in the National Football League. The football owners in the National Football League... They're the ones that are telling me what I need to do in the football league. Mm-hmm. So if you want to be a football player in the football league, you have to do what the league owners tell you to do. And I am, you know, take it up with other owners in the league. I'm not throwing these other teams under the bus.
Well, how can I take it up with them?
Well, you need to have a meeting. You need to organize a meeting of team leaders.
Let me put it to you like this. The Hilton Hulkamaniacs are as iconic to your league as the Dallas Cowboys are to the National Football League, and I am going to play the Jerry Jones to your Roger Goodell and hold up your contract negotiations as you seek an extension in years to come.
Listen, I've been meeting independently with DeMaurice Smith of the NFLPA.
Go right ahead.
Now, that actually was nothing to do with our fantasy football league. That was an unrelated thing we were meeting about. I just wanted to mention the information. But I'll think about your situation, and I'll come up with an appropriate response next week right here on the Hard Traveling Fanboys. So with that being said, folks, we are ready to get started with a segment that has been a part of our show since the dawn of time. A segment that Nick and I enjoy calling Reading and Watching.
Reading and Watching. What you be reading and watching?
What you been reading and watching?
Oh, God, Greg. Why are we delivering this like a Triple H promo?
Well, A, all things are better delivered as a Triple H promo. And B, the jingle was in the middle there, so.
Yes, but the 30-second intro before the jingle wasn't.
Well, quite frankly, Bruce, I'm just trying to give this show a little bit of oomph because God knows you ain't giving it anything.
Oh, for the love of God. The same old lines, week in and week out. Work through your catchphrases, Greg. Work through them.
Rumor and innuendo.
Are we gonna move on here? Or are we just gonna sit here all night?
I can sit here all night, baby. I got nothing but time.
Oh God, you know that's not true. People. You know that's not true.
Yes, we are gonna hit it off with the not the rundown with Reading of Reading and Watching fame. Yes, and Nick, what you been reading?
Nothing. I had another jam-packed weekend. Had a day on either side of that weekend, one to prepare and one to recover. And so I have not done a damn bit of reading. I am hoping to do a lot of reading this upcoming Friday, but I make no promises in that regard either.
That's not true, Nick. You've done a lot of reading of menus.
Well, I didn't really read a whole lot of menus this week. It's not really accurate.
You just knew what you were going to get when you went to all those restaurants?
Yes. I didn't eat at that many restaurants. I ate a lot of tailgate food.
Oh, that's true. That's a good point. I know what you got when you went to the one place. You got a corn dog and some other stuff.
I got a corn dog, a big double burger, and some French fries, and it was awesome.
Yeah. Not bad. Not bad. As for me, I've read one comic book over the last week, and that would be Aquaman number 18. This is the second part of a two-part, as it turns out, storyline called Warhead. I thought it was going to be longer than it was. This kind of wraps up this character of Warhead for now anyway, who starts out as a villain to Aquaman. And in this one, we find out that there's more than meets the eye to the character of Warhead. He's actually not really a bad guy at all. He's an organic machine kind of deal that is struggling with his mission and really actually abhors violence. He doesn't like violence, even though he made a man shoot himself in the last issue. This issue is written by Dan Abnett and drawn by Scott Eaton. And I have to say, this was probably the low point of Rebirth Aquaman for me to this point. I thought this two-parter was, the first part was fine. I thought this issue was not great. I thought it was kind of rushed through a little bit. It kind of felt like filler. Actually, it very much felt like filler. I thought it was a little convenient how it wrapped up. So not bad, really, but not great either, and kind of a letdown given how great Aquaman has been leading up to this. So looking forward to H 2.0, which is about to get started here, according to the last page of this one. Looking forward to that as I get into it. But 18, just pretty average.
Yeah, I would agree absolutely with your assessment of that little Warhead arc. I remember not really, I won't say being underwhelmed, but just being whelmed by it, if that makes any sense.
Yes. And a nice homage to Young Justice.
Indeed.
So that brings us to watching. And Nick, have you watched anything?
No. No.
No, you have not. And neither have I, as it turns out. As you know, we spoke last week, Nick, offline, and I mentioned one of the things I might do this weekend was watch the pilot episode of The Gifted on Hulu and perhaps watch The Runaways as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
As it turns out, Nick, I did neither. And
or instead, watch some more Luke Cage, maybe.
Right. And instead what I did was watch a whole ass load. That's right, an ass load of football and boxing.
Mm.
So
not a bad decision there. I did the same, but just with the football.
Football and boxing on Saturday and more football on Sunday. So
wow, that's interesting because mine was football and binge drinking on Saturday and then more football and binge drinking on Sunday. So there you are. Interesting parallels.
Hey, that's the same thing that most fraternities did over the weekend as well, from what I understand.
Hey, it is what it is, Greg. I'll ask Garner the next time I see him.
Anyway, yeah, so neither one of us watched a damn thing. We didn't read much. We really let you guys down this week, all four of you. So,
I apologize for nothing.
That's right. Moving on. It's our show, damn it. And so we're going to move on to our weekly look at the news and notes in the world comics. We're going to move on to the rundown. Nick, we've got a not exactly what I would call a bevy of news items this week.
No, pretty sparse news week in the world of comics and comics related media. So, where do you want to start us off this week?
I think we're going to start off in Marvel Comics,
we're
going to start off with the latest press release announcement from Marvel, which is announcing the official return of. And you have to specify this, adult Jean Grey.
Yes.
In Phoenix Resurrection.
Yes.
With a story by the newly exclusive writer Matthew Rosenberg of Secret Warriors and Punisher fame, with art by the famous Lenil Yu, who drew Secret Empire.
Parts of Secret Empire. Secret probably Empire was pretty heavily co-collaborated on from the art standpoint.
Probably best known for his collaboration with Mark Waid over the years. And Lenil Yu will be drawing it. He's a great artist. It says, here's a reading from the story at Newsarama. As a true celebration of the character's power and iconic status, the five-issue epic will also include five blockbuster artists taking on Jean Grey throughout the run, as well as Phoenix variant covers that will begin in December. Basically, the editor says Matt came to them with an idea that was interesting and unique to bring Jean back. It was unexpected, very cool mystery, and has what you'd expect from an X-Men epic, which, of course, would include things like action, romance, sacrifice, and putting the Inhumans over at their expense. but in seriousness, they're bringing back Jean Grey, who's one of the original founding X-Men. And I gotta be honest, this would have a lot more power if there weren't already a Jean Grey running around who is displaced from the 60s as a teen, but still staying in modern society instead of going back to the 60s. As current Jean Grey. So now we will have Jean Grey and Jean Grey.
Much like X-Men we currently universe. Have Iceman and Iceman.
Iceman and Iceman. And for a while we had Cyclops and Cyclops.
But he did.
But now we don't have Cyclops and Cyclops because old Cyclops is dead, leaving young 60s Cyclops still alive, but aging to become different old 60s Cyclops that aged.
I will acknowledge that I haven't read any of it, so I can't really comment on the convoluted nature of it. But you have this sarcastic tone in your voice, like this is the most convoluted X-Men thing of all time, when this is probably like no better than the 17th most convoluted X-Men story. Like, the early early and mid 90s were notorious for their for their convoluted labyrinthine plot structure.
Yes.
So let's not act
absolutely
like this is that much more ridiculous than any of that.
I'm just saying, Nick. I'm just saying. Are you really fired up about this?
No,
are you
I'm
fired
just,
up about the Gene Return.
It's just funny to me that you have such a massive aversion to the time displacement thing, but yet you are willing to accept all the kooky, crazy, like this person is both their uncle and their father stuff from the from the early 90s.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I'm just saying.
Because
time travel confusion is a well-worn trope of
absolutely.
X-Men comics at this point.
No, it absolutely is.
Let's just embrace it.
No. No, here's the thing, Nick. You've never read X-Men comics. You have no dog in this fight.
I don't. I really
I've read X-Men comics, and there's a difference. People will tell you that have read – there's a reason why people aren't reading X-Men comics today, that we're reading X-Men comics for
because Marvel
decades.
Craps on them and treats them like they don't matter?
Yeah, that's a big factor of it, and there's a factor of character inconsistency, and there's a factor of just throwing out the baby with the bathwater, so to speak. And okay, we've taken Cyclops down this road of this character path that we're not happy with, and we feel like we've turned him into a villain now. So we need to bring back the old Cyclops, but we need to bring him back as a youth. And make him young and hip and interesting again instead of redoing what DC did with Hal Jordan and redeeming him. So now you're getting Jean coming back from the dead, and I'm fine with that. I have no issue with Jean coming back. Jean always comes back. We get that. But my problem is I don't really want there to be – how many Wolverines are there going to be as of a few months, Nick?
Well, now, wait a minute. Old Man Logan is not called Wolverine. He's called Old Man Logan. So really, there's only one Wolverine, Greg. And she's not Wolverine. She's the all-new Wolverine, which is completely different.
Now, are they or are they not bringing back Wolverine?
I have not had that confirmed by anyone. I have not seen that touted. I believe he was in Generations, but I don't think that's going to be a lasting thing. That appears to be a series of time travel type stories.
Mm. And we got Old Man Logan. So we've got two Logans.
And we got Jimmy Hudson, the son of Ultimate Wolverine.
Oh, God, I forgot. Yes, Jimmy Hudson. Now we got all those Wolverine – all those – let me put it this way, Nick. All those Wolverine-like characters running around. how many Thors do we have right now?
Three at the moment. But one of those is very clearly not – or excuse me, two of those are very clearly not long for the Marvel Universe, it would seem.
I'm just saying, you know, I feel like overkill is an understatement when you've got that many – you know, and I would say the same thing if it were, you know, so let's say an organization where there were hundreds of Batmen all around the world. Not that that would ever happen. But – maybe two. Maybe you can sustain two. But I think in the case of Jean Grey, when you've got a character that is, again, not a mantle, but a character, mm-hmm. and you've got two of the exact same character, it's like, what's the point? And B, how is it not going to be confusing? But I mean, and granted, X-Men has always been confusing, but at least they would make the attempts to presume that it wasn't as confusing as it was. I don't know. I'm not really super excited about this, but maybe the story will be good. Have you ever read anything from Mr. Rosenberg?
No.
Neither have I. I was hoping you had. But nonetheless, it could be a great story, and Jean is one of the all-time best characters in Marvel. So hopefully it's a good story. Hopefully they bring her back in a compelling way, and hopefully they send the 60s X-Men back to the 60s.
She'll be around less than 5 years, my
official of course.
Prediction. And then she'll be
now,
again.
She's been killed by Scott. She's been killed by Logan.
Who hasn't she been killed by herself. At this point? Like,
well, we have to keep going through the list of the teammates. You know, I want to see Jubilee Killer next.
I want to see Darkseid kill her and then be upset that he killed her and then bring her back.
Bring her
and
back.
Be mad he has to bring her back.
Mm. Pity I have to bring her back. Tremendous. Anyway, let's move on from that. I didn't mean to be so negative on that. That was unnecessarily snarky on my part, and I apologize. But if they do bring back multiple genes, that's all the more women for Scott to cheat on each gene with when he comes back. So anyway,
that'll be the ultimate reveal, is that old Scott is cheating on Gene with teenage Gene, and that young Scott is cheating on teenage Gene with old Gene.
Old Gene. Oh, and I've gone cross-eyed. Oh, so let's move on to a little bit of video game news, Nick. Now, unlike me, you're living in the current generation of video games.
I am.
In that you have current systems with current games that are coming out currently. So,
yes.
One of those games is Injustice 2, a game that we have both played with each other and have enjoyed. We play a lot of games with each other, actually, and enjoy them. And this is a game that I have had some critique of, not for the game, but for the tendency of the studio to at times mislead fans about downloadable content. In particular, producer Ed Boon's obsession with including characters from his Mortal Kombat series in a game that is about DC Comics characters. However, they did recently announce the inclusion of Black Lightning, a longtime DC character who is getting his own show on the CW this fall. It says here that the character will be available as a premier skin variant of Mortal Kombat's Raiden, sold as part of the Fighter Pack 2 scheduled for release in October. So basically, you're going to have Raiden, who will be a regular character, and Black Lightning will be through, if you select his alternate attire, his alternate skin, will be available there. So presumably they'll have the same moveset and all that stuff. Your thoughts, Nick?
I kind of don't hate this one. I think if you're going to have the Mortal Kombat characters here, I think a cool way of getting around some of the complaints that you've had is by including these DC versions, these skins that you can kind of, you know, in this instance, Greg, if you never wanted to play as Raiden and only wanted to play as Black Lightning, there's nothing to prevent you from doing that. So
right.
I think this is an interesting way of having your cake and eating it too, and probably something they should have, you know, attempted to do with, who was it, Sub-Zero, I believe, as well.
Yeah, I agree. The
Which
only...
they did, actually. Didn't they give him a Mr. Freeze skin?
I have no idea.
I think they did. I remember.
You have the game. Just put it in and see.
I'm not going to put it in. It's in the other room.
Yeah, you never want to put it in, Nick. Yeah, so that's it's an interesting approach. I think the bummer there is that you're not going to get the – and I don't know if they do this actually with – now that I say it, I don't know if we do this with any of the downloadable characters. But presumably they won't get the custom interactions with other characters.
Actually, they probably will, because if the skin has custom voice acting, the voice acting will be different. I have noticed that for the various – alternate skins. I'm trying to remember what the other example was.
John Stewart.
Yeah, John Stewart had different interactions. So,
yes, some good ones. So maybe that's right. In that case, I'm okay with it. But again, I think they should do it with all the Mortal Kombat characters, and even better, just not include them and focus your time and effort into building unique DC characters and adding more into the game.
I was wrong about that being said, Sub-Zero one, by the way. He was Mr. Freeze was a skin for Captain Cold, not for Sub-Zero.
Ah, yeah. So anyway, still chances to fix it, but at least it's a step in the right direction. I agree with you, Nick. Good on him for that. And Black Lightning's a cool character and should have a cool power set. So that's that. Now, let's move on to where the bread is buttered. The source of all of our income, Nick. This is where we make our money, is off of the DCEU corner.
DCEU corner.
That's right. This controversial segment of our show, controversy creates cash. In our case, apparently we haven't created enough controversy. But nonetheless, Zack Snyder is not going to be returning to finish Justice League. Not that there was really any doubt about that. That was pretty well known already. But Zach was discussing his short film, Snow, Steam, Iron, and in the process of discussing that, confirmed that Justice League's post-production is entirely out of his hands, and he is not involved at all in the final steps of completing the film. Here's the quote from Snyder. "I'm at a place where I feel excited about it, and I'm happy for my guys, and I love these people that are working on it, and they're my family, and I think they've done an amazing job, but I've kind of just let them do their thing." Snyder, of course, left Justice League earlier this year following the death of his daughter, and Warner has brought in Joss Whedon to finish the film, and he's gotten a co-writer credit on it, but it's still Joss Whedon listed as the director. Nick, this interview really makes it seem like this is whatever vision Zach may have had for the movie. It feels like it's not necessarily going to be his movie anymore. Does it feel that way to you?
Yeah, that's been the rumor from various publications and online rumor mills that, you know, Warner Brothers was ordering massive changes to the film, and that Joss Whedon was being brought on to do a little bit more than just additional pickups. That has been a pretty persistent rumor ever since this happened. And if that winds up being the case, then this just makes a whole lot of sense. I mean, you can't have Snyder leave, you know, partway through the production and then return and then be trying to mesh the new footage that Joss has shot with the vision that Zach had. You kind of have to have a clean break at a certain point. And if that's what happened here, I think that's best for all parties involved. You don't want to have a film that ultimately is trying to serve two masters, which is one of my biggest concerns about Justice League at this point.
Right. It seems like it may end up being something of a Rogue One situation where it's a director.
Rogue One is a best case scenario.
Well, sure, in terms of quality, but I mean in terms of a director in name only.
Right. You know, you had that with Rogue One, like you said, with Gareth Edwards being replaced by, I believe it was Tony Gilroy, who came and oversaw some of the reshoots. You had a similar situation with the Han Solo standalone movie, although they had the decency there to at least go ahead and just fully replace the director and get the person they wanted in there to do the job. So, yeah, let's hope that Rogue One kind of set the template for the level of creative success that this can have, and it winds up being as cohesive a film as Rogue One was. I have my concerns about Justice League, but we are just a few short weeks away from finding out, you know, what all this was about.
Of course, the movie that got the whole DCEU started and took us down this road was the controversial Superman reboot, Man of Steel. That's a movie that, sorry people, Nick and I both really like.
Yep.
And it's going to get a sequel. We just don't know exactly when.
When?
Remember when? The director, whose name is heavily tied to this movie, nothing's official, nothing's been signed, but the director who has confirmed he's had discussions about directing this film is Matthew Vaughn, most well-known for directing the Kingsman series, a sequel of which is about to come out, X-Men First Class, I believe Wanted he directed. He's directed a litany of movies, Kick-Ass, and certainly has his feet all in on the comic book side of filmmaking. He recently talked about his vision for a Man of Steel sequel, and here's what he said to Collider. In quotes, "Weirdly, if I did do Superman, and I made the mistake of telling someone yesterday I have spoken about it, and then wallop, I think my main take would be, it's really boring, but make a Superman film. I just don't feel a proper Superman." Go back to the source material. For me, Superman is color, feel good, heroic. He's a beacon of light in the darkness, and that's what I think Superman should be. Now, Vaughn and Mark Miller pitched a Superman movie back in 2008 that never happened, but a lot's changed since 2008. So, a lot to kind of unpack here in those seemingly innocuous statements. To my ears, both promising and potentially concerning.
Yes.
I'll start with the concerning part.
Yes.
The concerning part is that sounds an awful lot like what
Superman Returns. Yep.
Was saying going into the movie Superman Returns, which, in my opinion, failed because it was too lovingly faithful.
Yes.
To the Richard Donner version of Superman, which, again, both of us like. That's right. You can like both the Richard Donner Superman and Man of Steel. It's possible.
Mm-hmm.
So that's concerning to me, Nick, because I don't want a recreation of the Richard Donner Superman.
The Richard Donner take on Superman is not the only valid take on Superman, regardless of what some people would have you believe. And I suppose you and I both having similar concerns about this context, this quote, is only if we're taking it in the context of carrying it out to an extreme. Because
right.
Really, Superman Returns and Singer's reverence for the Donner film was carried out to an extreme. They were seeking
yes.
to essentially continue that line of films and recreate the tone and the look of those films as painstakingly as they possibly could. What I would assume that Vaughn means, and perhaps what could wind up being a best of both worlds approach, is the part that you refer to that could be really exciting. Because if you take a Donner-like approach to the characterization of Superman and yet use the technology at your disposal and Matthew Vaughn's undisputed fantastic eye for action to create a hybrid of the, you know, more traditional version of Superman with a modern action-based Superman film, that has a lot of potential to win
Absolutely.
Over both fans of Man of Steel and fans of the original Donner version, and could wind up being kind of this hybrid that could really work if that's what we wind up getting.
Absolutely, and I think you're right. I have to assume that's what he means, that he's not going to come in and just try to redo Superman from the 70s in 2019 or 20 or whenever we get this movie. I have to assume that what you're talking about is what he's going to do. And honestly, that's kind of what we've seen in the comics in the last year, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
We've seen a modern and fresh take on Superman, but a return of Superman to those values and to that characterization that would not feel out of place in a Richard Donner Superman film.
Indeed.
They've brought Superman back to his roots. They've brought Superman back to being, as it mentioned in the article and in that interview, color, light, a beacon of hope. And that's what Superman is. And that is the fundamental truth of his character. And to me, doesn't get a lot better than that. So if he can find a way to marry those two ideas of the modern fresh take on the mythos with that traditional characterization, there's a lot of greatness that could be had there. And with that being said, that notwithstanding, I think we've reached the end of the road, Nick.
We have. That's the end of the podcast this week. One of our shorter efforts in recent memory.
And it's good. And it was good.
And it was, for us at least. We don't really care if it was good for you too.
That's right. Oh, and we should probably mention, Nick, last week we told people
we're
going to be doing an episode of this podcast that was a Long Book Hunters episode on Southern Bastards. Well, obviously that didn't happen. And the reason for that, we're not going to get into right now. But we are going to do that episode, and we're going to do that episode for you next week.
Indeed.
Right, Nick?
That is the plan. Our plan is to do that next week, so we'll hopefully have that to bring to you on next week's episode. And that, of course, will be the final episode of the month of September. And then we move into our second annual Walking Dead month in October as we celebrate, you know, the return of the ratings juggernaut, The Walking Dead on AMC, and the month of October, which is, you know, known for Halloween with some horror-themed content centered around Walking Dead. So we'll have more Walking Dead comics to review. We will have... I believe we're also going to take a look at the Telltale Walking Dead first season of that game as well. And mm-hmm. also, I believe we had planned, you know, last year we did our top five Walking Dead characters with Jennifer Smith. I think we're going to bring Jennifer back on and do our bottom five Walking Dead characters, which should be something of a unique situation.
I have a feeling your list might be the most predictable list in the history of Countdown.
There are five spots, Greg, and not all of them can be taken up by Carl, unfortunately.
Well, it's going to be a month filled with adventure, a month filled with Kangs, a month filled with Rangs, a month filled with Kang of the Rang tournaments. It's going to be a great month, ladies and gentlemen. We hope you enjoy it. And, yeah, so if you have any feedback on the show, let us know. Contact us through the ways mentioned. Before we go off the air, wanted to take a minute to mention the passing of the legendary Bobby the Brain Heenan, obviously the greatest manager in wrestling history, arguably the greatest commentator in wrestling history, a big part of the childhoods of both of the hard-traveling fanboys. Nick, any you know, I know he did this with Roddy Piper a few weeks ago, but standout memories of the Brain.
Oh, man, pretty much any time he was on commentary. You know, it's hard to pick out just one. But then, of course, my wrestling fandom, his years-long feud with Hulk Hogan and his quest to destroy Hulkamania, always enjoyed that, whether it was King Kong Bundy or, you know, any member of the Heenan family that he was running out there at him, most notably Andre the Giant. And then, of course, his commentary work in WCW was also outstanding. Him being drunk at Hogwild 96 is a highlight. If you have not experienced that, you should check that out at some point. Just it's really hard to find too many duds from the guy's career. He is one of the most remarkably consistent performers in the history of the wrestling industry. So if you're not familiar with Bobby the Brain Heenan, go to the WWE Network, go to YouTube, go to whatever platform you prefer, and do a little research. You will find one of the most gifted talkers in the history of potentially any entertainment medium.
No doubt, no doubt. And if you want to hear a master class in wrestling commentary, go to the 1992 Royal Rumble and watch the 1992 Royal Rumble match. It is a if there was no match happening in the ring, you would still watch. If it was just an empty ring, you would still watch this for an hour because of how great he is on commentary alongside Gorilla Monsoon. Just a phenomenal performer, as Nick pointed out, in so many facets. And I will leave you with a little bit of brain wisdom as we go off the air. Always remember, a friend in need is a pest.
Got two weekly segments coming to your town.
Reading, watching, and the rundown.
Do-do-do-do-do-do.
Thank you.
It's the greatest show on Place to Be Nation.
Certainly a unique situation.
Ooh, hot driving fanboys.
They're indivisible, they're microwavable. Ooh, hot traveling fanboy, oi, 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 oi.
Are you gonna give me fucking anything on this show, or why are we even here?
Listen up, you slap dick. Let me answer the fucking question, if you give me a minute.
Well, Klondike Bill told me that if he ever came across a woman who was extremely clean and well kept, he would tell her to put on pair of sweatpants and a sweatshirt, go take a 2-mile jog, and then come back and see him when she was done.
Ma.
Thank you.
I'm traveling fanboys. 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 I'm traveling fanboys.